This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehisu Ibin Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It will come as a blow to people, especially as we are approaching the festive season, because this is the only time where people have a lot of time to travel and be with their relatives. But again, you need to be alive to be able to enjoy with your relatives.
That's Msolisi Nkubi, who, like many South Africans, fears stricter COVID-19 lockdown regulations may be returning for the holidays. Details coming up also. The UN says COVID-19 conflict and lack of humanitarian aid are increasing levels of acute hunger around the world. And Ethiopia's prime minister is defending military operations against the country's well-armed Tigray region. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. South Africa's COVID-19 infection rate is sharply rising again, and the government has sent a stern warning it could trigger a return to strict lockdown regulations. The government says President Cyril Ramaphosa will address the nation next week, leaving citizens envisioning a damper on the festive season. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Minister in the presidency, Jacob Mtembu, told the media that the government is very much concerned by the rising infection figures. He said some South Africans are behaving recklessly and irresponsible, as if COVID-19 no longer exists. He warned that such behavior could prompt the government to review the current relaxed lockdown regulations.
Cabinet calls on all people in South Africa to continue adhering to the health protocols of practicing social distancing, wearing masks all the time when in public, and washing our hands with water and soap or an alcohol-based sanitizer. And of course, we must avoid large gatherings.
According to the latest figures from the Department of Health, the past few weeks has seen a rise in the number of daily infections. Close to 2,000 new cases were reported yesterday, after that number had been contained below 1,000 for some time. Experts have warned that this could be the start of a second wave. Shabir Madi is a professor at the School of Pathology at the University of Witwatersrand.
And the main reason for this resurgence is because of complacency creeping in with regard to the behavior of people, in particular the wearing of face masks, avoiding overcrowded settings, especially in closed, poorly ventilated areas, and not maintaining physical distancing.
Madi warns that without behavior change, the gains made in the fight against COVID-19 could soon diminish. Ramaphosa's address to the nation next week looms like a storm cloud. Many, like Msolisi Ncube, fear stricter lockdown regulations that will sour the holidays.
It will come as a blow to people, especially as we are approaching the festive season, because this is the only time where people have a lot of time to travel and be with their relatives. But again, you need to be alive to be able to enjoy with your relatives. So would rather be safe than sorry.
Over 700,000 people have been infected by the coronavirus in South Africa, ranking it 13th on the world list of COVID-19 infections. However, the country's recovery rate stands at 91.7%, making it one of the best. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Kenya, the first group of volunteers is undergoing clinical trials of a vaccine developed in Britain for COVID-19. It's part of a global effort to test the vaccine developed by the University of Oxford and the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca, as we hear from Lenny Ruvaga in Nairobi.
About 40 volunteers, mostly frontline health workers, are participating in the COVID-19 vaccine clinical trials in Kenya. The trial phase of the vaccine, developed by the University of Oxford in partnership with a pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca, is being conducted by the KEMRI Wellcome Trust Research Program based in Kilifi. One of the researchers at KEMRI, Dr. Samuel Sang, says they are trying to determine if the vaccine known as Chadox and COVID-19 is safe for Kenyans.
Vaccines that have been found to work and are safe in one population does not necessarily mean it will work across populations. Therefore, the need for assessment whether the Chadox 1 and COVID-19 vaccine is safe and works among Kenyan volunteers to ensure that Kenyans can benefit from the vaccine, that is, if it proves to be successful.
Dr. Sang says the vaccine is being tested for both safety and impact.
Our expectation is to assess whether Chadox 1 and COVID-19 vaccine is safe, effective, and elicits a good immune response in adults who are above the age of 18 years.
According to the World Health Organization, there are about 100 COVID-19 vaccines currently under the human trial phase of development. But some analysts say that while vaccine research and development are advancing, the equitable distribution of a COVID-19 vaccine remains a question. A recent study by the Duke Global Health Innovation Center argues that high-income countries will have an undue advantage in accessing the vaccines once developed. Andrea Taylor is the Assistant Director for Programs at the Duke Global Health Innovation Center.
Our results need to be understood in the context of limited manufacturing capacity. High- and middle-income countries have already reserved 3.8 billion doses with options for another 5 billion before any vaccines are even on the market. So when vaccine candidates do receive approval, the doses that can be manufactured in the first year or two may already be reserved for high-income countries.
But Taylor says that outcome is not set in stone.
Leadership from lower-income countries is changing the conversation. For example, the African Union and the Africa CDC are coordinating an Africa-wide approach to pool financing for vaccine procurement and to increase manufacturing within Africa. We're seeing similar initiatives emerge in Latin America as well. These regional partnerships are really exciting and could strengthen lower-income countries' leverage and their position on the global market.
Kenya's health ministry says an additional 360 volunteers will be added to the human trial phase once the efficacy and safety of the vaccine has been established over the next 12 months in the first batch of volunteers. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
United Nations food agencies are warning that COVID-19 conflict and lack of humanitarian aid are increasing levels of acute hunger around the world, with several countries on the brink of famine. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The World Food Program reports more than 100 million people globally already are suffering from severe food shortages. It warns that number is expected to increase by another 121 million without urgent action to combat this rising tide of global acute hunger. A new assessment by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and World Food Program has identified 20 countries as acute food insecurity hotspots. The report warns four of these hotspots, Burkina Faso in West Africa's Sahel region, northeastern Nigeria, South Sudan, and Yemen, could soon slip into famine if conditions continue to deteriorate over the coming months. FAO senior food crises analyst Luca Russo says there's no evidence of a famine occurring now in these countries.
Essentially, the moment you declare a famine, it's already too late to act, in the sense that we saw this in the past with Somalia when the famine was declared. Already 260,000 people had died because of the famine. So we want to raise an early warning before a famine occurs, and we want also to highlight some of the key factors that need to be monitored.
The report cites intensification of violence, economic crises exacerbated by COVID-19, weather extremes, and a lack of humanitarian access as key drivers of hunger. These factors, it notes, have caused the number of desperately hungry people to almost triple since 2019 in Burkina Faso. They also are behind food insecurity and high levels of acute malnutrition in children in Yemen. Russo tells VOA that insecurity and hunger are rising in Borno State in northeastern Nigeria, where Boko Haram militants remain a dangerous force.
These are areas where basically today there is no possibility of having humanitarian access. So that means that the people are left on their own. in a situation where, in which many of them are displaced. And this is what can trigger the famine. In South Sudan, we are talking of Jonglei's estate, and there is a bit better access, but there are floods and conflicts and so on. People are displaced.
The UN Food Agency say the world is at a catastrophic turning point. Unless urgent action is taken now, they warn the world could experience its first outbreak of famine since it was last declared in 2017 in parts of South Sudan. That famine affected 5.5 million people and put more than 200,000 children suffering acute malnutrition at risk of death. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Ethiopia's prime minister is defending military operations against the country's well-armed Tigray region, saying months of patiently trying to resolve differences have failed. Abiy's government is mobilizing troops from around the world after 2 days of clashes between government forces and a powerful ethnic faction that led the country's ruling coalition for decades. Communications in the region are cut off and news on developments is challenging to obtain. Some in the international community urgently call for dialogue as one of Africa's most powerful and populous country nears civil war. As the U.S. awaits the announcement of the winner of the presidential election, new candidates are celebrating election victories at the state and local level. Obala Obala, a 27-year-old former refugee from Ethiopia, won a city council election in Austin, Minnesota. He spoke to VOA Salim Salomon and shared what the victory means to him.
So when I decided to do door knocking, a lot of people are already familiar with my face. That make it more easier for me and my team. But the challenge was that even though my name is visible outside there, not everyone watch TV or read magazine or that. I have to introduce myself to tell my vision and why I'm running, because I have to appeal to the voters and the resident that I will be the right person to fit, especially me being a new immigrant in town who just been in America for 6 years and someone who just moved from refugee a few years ago with only one pants and one shirt in his hand and now he's running for office. It was kind of a challenge, but I told the voter that the American dream, you don't have to be rich to come to America. You can come to this country with nothing. And if you work hard, you will achieve the American dream. And my story appealed to them. And that way I earned their vote today.
Yeah. Again, thank you for that heartfelt response. What does American dream mean to you as someone who came 6 years ago and you are here today?
The American dream means to me, I ran away from Gambela, Ethiopia. I live in a refugee camp where I stay 2 days sometime where I don't have meal to eat. I don't have any good school. The American dream to me is living a comfortable life whereby I can drive a car, or where my mom and my dad did not have the experience to drive a car. The American dream is I have a job that I'm comfortable going, knowing that my daughter will not have to worry about their next meal tomorrow. The American dream is that I have a country that I'm so proud of to call myself an American citizen, whereby I can serve and help the community. The American dream is that anything I put my dream into it, anything I put my mind into it, if I work hard for it, I can achieve it. That's how I define my American dream. Every day I talk to new immigrant or my fellow African, those who came to this beautiful country.
That was Obala Obala, a 27-year-old former refugee from Ethiopia, who is now a city council member in Austin, Minnesota. Palestinian authorities are protesting Malawi's plan to open an embassy in Jerusalem, which, if carried out, would make it the first African country to do so. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas sent an envoy to Malawi Thursday asking President Lazarus Chakwera to withdraw the plan, calling it a violation of a UN resolution on the disputed territory. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Briefing reporters after presenting the protest letter to President Chakwera at his state house in the capital, Lilongwe, Palestinian envoy Hanan Jarrah said Malawi's decision is a cause of great concern.
This is the main concern for us. This is the issue of sovereignty. This is the issue of recognizing the state of Palestine. This is the issue of violating international law and violating the international parameters when it comes to the status of Jerusalem.
The letter from Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas asked Chakwera to reconsider Malawi's plans for an embassy in Jerusalem. Israel considers the city its eternal capital, but Palestinians want East Jerusalem seized in a 1967 Middle East war as part of a future state. Jarrah said Jerusalem is still a disputed territory, and any action that seeks to alter the character and status of the city violates UN Security Council Resolution 476, approved in 1980 and reaffirmed in 2016 by Resolution 2334.
Malawi should be with the international community. Malawi shouldn't choose to be on the wrong side of history. Malawi shouldn't choose to follow an apartheid state.
Currently, only the United States and Guatemala have embassies in Jerusalem. President Chakwera first announced the decision to open an embassy in Jerusalem in his State of the Nation address in September, sparking a heated debate among Malawians. Chakwera told Parliament recently that Malawi is a sovereign state and its decision cannot be influenced by any foreign nation or institution.
Madam Speaker, I wish to appeal to this august house and the nation that we should never conduct our foreign policy and international cooperation at the behest of pressure from anybody. We should conduct our diplomacy and international relations on the basis of mutual respect and equality of all states under international law.
After delivering the letter, Jarrah said she could not tell Chakwera's position on the matter.
His Excellency was very clear on the position of Malawi recognizing the state of Palestine in 1989. He was very clear about that, and he said that he appreciates this kind of engagement. He appreciates the letter sent by President Abbas. He will have a look at, and they will discuss it internally.
Sherif Kais is a political science lecturer at Blantyre International University. He told VOA that Malawi should tread carefully to avoid being caught up in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict over disputed territory.
We are saying the embassy should be opened, but why not in Tel Aviv? Because if you look at Israel, they have quite a lot of, many countries that have their own embassies right there in Tel Aviv, not particularly in Jerusalem. So this is where we are saying why Malawi is putting itself at the tight corner, because this issue is about security. Because if you go into war zone, definitely expect the fragments of the war zone to come to your side as well.
Kaisi said President Chakwera should have held wider national consultations before he made his decision. Malawi's Foreign Affairs Minister, Ezinhoa Nkaka, is visiting Israel right now, advancing Malawi's plans to open an embassy in Jerusalem next year. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Recent data on sex workers in Zimbabwe indicates a high percentage of them are infected with HIV/AIDS, a health problem that is exacerbated by social stigma. Adigando gives us more from Bulawayo.
AVET, a UK-based organization focusing on collecting AIDS and HIV information data across the world, says 40% of sex workers in Zimbabwe are HIV positive. According to AVET's new report, there are around 44,500 female sex workers in Zimbabwe, and they are among the groups at highest risk of contracting or spreading HIV. UNAIDS says Zimbabwe has one of the highest HIV prevalence rates in sub-Saharan Africa at 12.8%, with 1.4 million people living with HIV/AIDS in 2019. The epidemic in Zimbabwe is largely driven by unprotected heterosexual sex. Women are disproportionately affected, particularly adolescent young girls and young women. The number of cases is growing among some groups, such as sex workers and men who have sex with men who are at higher risk of HIV. Information of these populations is lacking, as only a minimal amount of data is collected and reported in national documents. Other high-risk groups are drug users and prison inmates. Avet says the problem for both sex workers and members are compounded because their work is illegal in Zimbabwe. Avet's latest report says the social stigma and discrimination keeps many sex workers from seeking health care. Nozipo Moya is a researcher who consults for the Sex Workers Alliance of Zimbabwe, a group of 15 organizations that work with sex workers and the LGBT community. Moya says sex workers suffer discrimination when seeking health care.
There's a health code of conduct or protocol that facilities should adhere to, which is there and stated on paper. But the reality, according to the research, specifically on public institutions, public hospitals, sex workers have claimed there's been stigma and discrimination. Henceforth, you see institutions like which has started mobile clinics specifically to attend to the health issues for sex workers. Other service providers like PSI have been offering these specific services to key populations because the public health facilities, government-led facilities, have failed to protect health issues for sex workers.
Moya says sex workers' vulnerability to HIV is worsened by police intimidation. Police in some cases arrest them for loitering with intent to solicit for prostitution. In 2015, the Constitutional Court had outlawed the arbitrary arrest of prostitutes, but soliciting for sex remains a crime in the country. The Center for Sexual Health, HIV and AIDS Research found that 20% of female sex workers in Zimbabwe had experienced some sort of violence from the police. Sinatra Nyati, the regional director of the National AIDS Council in Zimbabwe, says sex workers face a plethora of challenges that exacerbate their HIV status, including the country's worsening economic environment.
The positivity rate for sex workers, according to their report, is more than 45%. I think it was 53%. The reason being that sex workers are exposed to HIV by their clients. Due to the economic challenges, clients are actually offering sex workers more money for unprotected sex. So this becomes a challenge, such that the sex workers will choose to go for unprotected sex for more because of the harsh economic conditions.
Nyati says another worrying dynamic is the increasing number of young girls entering into sex work. They usually lack the ability to negotiate with clients for safer sex.
So we also have the workplace programs where we are trying to reach out to men and talk about prevention programs in terms of HIV. But the challenge also remains that we are also experiencing a lot of young girls going into sex work because of the harsh economic condition. Some of them, they don't even have birth certificates to continue their education. So they find themselves into sex work. And these girls are not experienced. They cannot even negotiate for safer sex.
Moya explains the power dynamic for young sex workers.
When it comes to negotiation, the client would have an upper say depending on how much they're willing to fork, because these are bread and butter issues. We acknowledge how the information sensitization has been there for sex workers, but it's now an issue of bread and butter. It's an issue for the economic meltdown and the increase of child-headed families. These are the people who have actually flooded the sex work industry.
As the country's economy continues a long slide, millions of Zimbabweans have crossed the borders in search of jobs, leaving unattended minors heading homes and being exposed to the sex trade to eke out an existence. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Blawayo.
That wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music. On the African Beat, African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor, sukus, afrobeat and dumbolo, and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all, and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.